back to the America Uncomplicated podcast. We're going to do something a little different this week. Person I know brought to my attention a group of people over in Myanmar, called the Rohingya. And I really didn't know anything about these people. And so with the news this week in the U.S., you know, we're coming up on a couple deadlines, you know, with DACA and, you know, this Iran deal and a couple other things. But there wasn't anything I saw that I could say, okay, I can focus on this. And so when this was brought to my attention, I started looking into it a little bit. And I tell you what, this is one interesting story. I think that you might want to hang around and listen to this one because it encompasses quite a few things that even the U.S. is dealing with refugees and certain statuses with citizens and all that. And it's all wrapped into one thing here, which is kind of interesting. And so the way you spell this group of folks is R-O-H-I-N-G-Y-A. So if you get a chance and you want to look them up, I'd encourage you to do so because this story is quite wild, would be a way I would say to explain it. So let's jump right into it here. If you don't know where Myanmar is, it's what used to be Burma. You may recognize the phrase Indochina Burma. So you're talking basically over in, you know, Southeast Asia. And so within Myanmar, which was Burma, it used to be under British rule. And this was, you know, post-World War II, pre-World War II, before in 1948, this area, which was known as Burma at the time, achieved its independence. And with that independence has been one of the longest-running civil wars in the world. And there's been a military rule, or a junta, that's been in power there from 1962 to about 2010, and is also classified as one of the least developed nations in the entire world. And so the area that formerly known as Burma here really hasn't progressed much, you could say, since the British left the place in about 1948. And what is interesting is I started looking into this, and I thought, okay, well, I thought, you know, this Indochina Burma, you associate Burma with India. And Britain had actually made the area Burma here as a part of the provinces of India in 1866. But then when the British left and Burma gained its independence, they did not change the name of this place until 1989. And that's when it changed from Burma to Myanmar. And so the crisis that we're talking about that exists now with the Rohingya people can kind of be traced back to, I would say, basically when this military junta became in control, which was 1962. Because these people, and we'll talk a little bit more about them here in a second, they actually had served in the Burmese parliament up until the dictatorships took over in 62. To where they were an active participant in the government of Burma at the time. But since the junta, the military junta, has taken control, these people have no political rights. And I think before I get into too much detail regarding this group in particular, it's important to know kind of what the UN says is a refugee and certain things that refugees are entitled to or not entitled to. And this all goes back to something called the Convention Relating to the Status of Refugees, which is also known as the 1951 Refugee Convention. And what the United Nations did is it put together a multilateral treaty that defines who is a refugee, sets out the rights of these individuals who are granted asylum, and then the responsibilities of the nations that grant these people asylum. And what this convention also did in 1951 was it sets out who does not qualify as a refugee. And the easiest example that I can give you to that would be a war criminal. You're not going to classify them as a refugee. You're probably going to want to bring them to trial. And so, although this refugee convention, which was convened in Geneva, Switzerland, was, in Geneva, it's somewhat misinterpreted, or I'd say referred to in the wrong light, because it is not the Geneva Convention. That term is more widely, I'd say, understood as referring to like treaties that regulate armed conflict, to where the Refugee Convention here, it kind of builds upon the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which sets up the stage that allows persons to seek asylum from persecution in other countries. And so the status of a refugee was established here by this convention in 1951 in Geneva. And when you look for exactly who is or what is a refugee, the refugee statement, which I'm going to read to you here, it is somewhat all-encompassing. And it says it's a person who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality. So let's just take, for instance, the Syrian refugee crisis we got going on right now. Okay, so in order to be claimed or have the status of a refugee, you've got to have a fear that you're being persecuted for a certain reason, and you have to be outside the country of the nationality, which AKA in this part is Syria. Okay, and the definition goes on and says, is unable or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country, which means they don't feel like they have adequate protection within their home country, which in our example here is Syria. And it says, or who, not having a nationality and being outside the country of his former habitual residence as a result of such events, is unable or owing to such fear, is unwilling to return. So basically, in a nutshell, it says if you are outside your country of origin or your country of habitual residence because of fear of persecution, you can be classified as having the status of a refugee. And from that point, you are therefore granted certain rights, and you are basically, I would say, putting a responsibility on any of these parties that signed the 1951 Refugee Convention. And I'm not going to go through every single one of these rights that you are able to have as a refugee, but I'm going to give you some examples here. So if you're one of the countries that signed this thing, and you have a refugee that can prove they're a refugee via the UN definition, you have to allow them certain things, and you cannot do certain things. One thing you cannot do is you can't discriminate against them. You can't expect them to pay taxes. You can't expel them. And you can't forcibly return them to the country from which they fled, which is a little bit of common sense, but it makes some sense. You don't want to send them back to where they came from. They left there, you assume, for a reason. What you have to do for refugees is provide free access to the courts, provide administrative assistance, exempt refugees from reciprocity, and then also you can't, or you're supposed to provide travel identity papers for them. And there's some other things that go into this. If you got some interest in it, I encourage you to look up to look this up. But what I did find also is that although the convention and the states that signed it, which the rest of the world calls, what we call countries, states, so we just call them countries. But even though that convention is legally binding, there's no monitoring body that oversees this to make sure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. So if a refugee feels like they're being unfairly treated by the state that is, I guess, temporarily hosting them, if you want to say, from their fear of another place that they fled from, that an individual can lodge a complaint with the UN Human Rights Committee. And, you go through this process and all this stuff, but, it says nations can levy some international sanctions against violators. So say somebody brings suit against the United States, says they're not allowing me to do what your convention says. No country has ever taken legal action or levied international sanctions against another country that may possibly be violating that agreement. And so it said in my research that at present, the only real consequences of a violation are one, public shaming in the press, where they can say, well, they're not treating them right, and two, verbal condemnation of the violator by the United Nations and other nations. So it doesn't seem like, regardless of you're supposed to abide by this or not, there's really not any consequences to it other than, the press can say you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. So in getting back to the Rohingya, it's kind of a sad and interesting story here. They, like I'd mentioned before, were very active when Burma, or what's now known as Myanmar, had its independence in 1948. But since the military junta and the military rule has come in 1962, these people were classified as stateless and have been described as the world's most persecuted minority population ever, of which they are a majority Muslim ethnic group. And they've proved that they have lived in this nation of Myanmar slash Burma for centuries, but they are not recognized as doing that. And their homeland is actually, and I don't know if I can pronounce this right, I think it's the Rakhine or Rakan state in Myanmar, up to Bangladesh's district, as well as several other countries in Asia. Where these folks have sought sanctuary since the 1970s. So, without looking at a map to try to explain this to you, where this Rakhine state is, or Rakhine state is to the left. If you imagine a square here, it's basically on the left-hand side is where their traditional area that they've been, where they live. That is, their ethnic homeland. And so a lot of them have left there and fled to Bangladesh, which is on the bottom left-hand side of India. Some have also went into Thailand and other places. So within the research, it said there was about 1 million or so of these people, and around 450,000 of them have fled up to Bangladesh. Since August 25th of 2017. And what they end up doing is they basically end up in refugee camps. If you've got some interest in this, you can look up the Palestinian refugee crisis, which might make for a really good podcast, to where you can see the camps that they've lived in the Gaza Strip and other areas, to where they talk a lot, the Palestinians talk a lot about right of return. They just want to go home, but Israel's got some things in place that won't allow them to do it. And then obviously here in Myanmar, you have some issues with basically the military government performing ethnic cleansing on these people. And so when they fled, their ethnic homeland here and headed up into the area around Bangladesh. They've set up these camps, and a couple example, one's called the Rubber Garden, another one is Thankali, and there's more than 50,000 people in some of these camps, all the way down to less than about 25,000 folks in some of the camps. And I think you can imagine the conditions that these people are living in, obviously, are not good. But within the rest of the research, it said since the late 1970s, they believe that somewhere around 1 million of these folks have fled Myanmar due to widespread persecution. What I found interesting was the Saudis have let in 200,000 of these people, and they are majority Muslim, this group of folks, but that's quite a ways from Myanmar. And they say that there's about 120,000 Rohingya that are still within the Rakhine state. But what they call these folks is IDPs, which is an internally displaced person. And I'm going to give you a pretty good example here to explain IDPs. If you think about the hurricanes that we've had come into the United States just within this past 2, 3 months or whatever, if a person cannot return to their place of residence, they're technically an IDP. So say if somebody around the Houston area was forcibly removed from their house because of the hurricane, they just had to leave and the house was destroyed. If they are living somewhere else, technically they're classified as an IDP, as an internally displaced person. And the country of origin, meaning the United States in the example I'm giving you, is responsible for them. So when you look back at Myanmar and the Rohingya people, these 120,000 IDPs that are supposedly still living in their ethnic homeland in the Rakhine state, the government of Myanmar is supposed to take care of these folks, but they don't, which obviously has created this crisis here. And so, when you look at some other things that went on with this group of folks is they were denied citizenship in 1982 by the Myanmar nationality law, to where I looked it up, and this law actually says there's three classifications of citizens. One is you're a citizen. Another one is associated citizen. And then another one is what they call a naturalized citizen. And some of it boils down to, you got a relative or a grandparent, that lived there before time, and some of those type of things. But to be a real citizen of Myanmar, you have to be a member of an indigenous race, have a grandparent that was a member of the indigenous race, or you lived in Burma prior to 1942, which is about the time the Japanese came in there. And so these folks, the Rohingya, they claim and have shown that they were residents of this area all the way back to, shoot, the 8th century. But the military junta doesn't recognize that. They say, no, you weren't. And so as a result, these folks are considered stateless. They have no home. And it's been years and years and years, obviously, since 1982, but this crisis isn't getting any better. And they say these folks are fleeing from there to Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand. I brought up the Saudi Arabia example there. And then I started looking whether or not the United States ever really addressed this issue. And they have. In 2014, the U.S. House of Representatives actually passed a resolution on the persecution of these people and condemned the Myanmar government. And they said they need to end the discrimination and the persecution of the Rohingya people. Now, you might think that, okay, so if the UN knows about this, the United States knows about this, why doesn't somebody go in there? Well, the Myanmar government actually came out with a report. And they said it was highly controversial, obviously, that found no evidence of systematic violence against the Rohingya But the country of Myanmar has refused to allow the UN or any outside organization or journalist in to conduct an independent investigation, which is why the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, a guy by the name of Zayed Raad Al Hussein, he called this whole thing going on here a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And I don't think there's too many people that would dispute, maybe outside of the Myanmar government, that this is actually going on there. So, hopefully, I wasn't too sure where I was going to go with this, but hopefully I was able to maybe educate you a little bit on a crisis that, we haven't heard a whole lot about, which is these Rohingya people. And maybe I can continue this theme for the next podcast and maybe talk a little bit about the Palestinian refugee situation, maybe even the Syrian refugee situation, depending on what happens in the news. But if something big comes up, obviously, in the news this week, I will definitely put that on there as well. But once again, I'd like to thank you for tuning in to the America Uncomplicated podcast. Seems like we're doing pretty good on listenership, so I appreciate everybody coming back week after week, or if you miss a couple weeks, at least trying to get caught up on what we're talking about here. And I will try to put some articles up on the website, americauncomplicated.com, about this specific issue that we talked about, which is the Rohingya crisis. And if you got some further interest, you're more than welcome to email me at americauncomplicated@gmail.com. Or even donate to the podcast while you're over on the website. So, once again, thanks for tuning in, and we will talk to you next week.